Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Trauma and Expressive Arts Therapy, Brain, Body, and Imagination in the Healing Process by Kathy A. Malchiotti, narrated by Marie Jenkins. Publisher's Note: In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures, tables, and appendices present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface. One of my earliest childhood recollections is of a reparative experience involving the arts and imagination. My maternal grandmother had just died, and it was the first time I lost a close and beloved relative. My father somehow sensed that his little girl needed something more than comforting words to help her heal from this loss. He let me use leftover house paint and a wall in our unfinished basement to create whatever I wanted. I used those paints to cover that wall with images of birds, animals, and the dense woods in back of our Connecticut home. I also remember simply taking the brushes and moving the paint rhythmically across the surface, sometimes while listening to music on the radio. After school, each day and on weekends, I looked forward to spending time alone with what became a canvas for expressing feelings while dancing to favorite songs. I never forgot this experience, and many others involving the healing capacity of the arts during childhood and adolescence. I always returned to drawing, painting, dance, theater, and music as ways to untangle my emotions and restore a sense of aliveness when experiencing distress or loss. These moments eventually led me to want to become an artist and to study the visual arts and theater in college, but I always carried the belief that the arts were more than an exhibition, recital, or performance. I recognized that imagination and play had another, larger purpose, because when engaged in creative experiences, I was able to transcend crises more easily. Later, when I pursued a doctorate in psychology, it was natural for me to want to continue my quest to understand just how and why the arts and imagination were reparative. In graduate school, I bumped up against prevailing talking cure approaches that continue to be the dominant ways of treating traumatic stress. Language is, of course, a necessary means of communication, but it is only an approximation of our experiences when it comes to articulating distress. Ultimately, words never quite convey just how the brain and body experience trauma. Sooner or later, they inevitably fail us when it comes to feelings and sensations of anxiety, terror, dissociation, and loss of pleasure in living that come with unresolved trauma's aftermath. Long before the talking cure became a thing, humans turned to arts-based expression as a way of transforming difficulties when confronted by crisis, tragedy, or loss. As a species, we have been turning to the healing rhythms and synchrony of the arts to confront and resolve distress for thousands of years. These actions emerged not only as individual forms of reparation, but also through social engagement, capitalizing on connection with others and community as agents of healing. In recent years, nonverbal approaches, including an emphasis on the body's response to trauma, have emerged as accepted and effective methods to address and resolve traumatic stress. Some of these approaches, like neurofeedback and reprocessing protocols, focus on literally changing the brain's perception and responses to traumatic memories and reactions. Others are more somatically based and emphasize the recognition and transformation of the body's response to trauma. Despite this increase in recognition of the role of nonverbal and implicit communications in the treatment of trauma, expressive arts therapy, the integrative use of movement, music, sound, art, improvisation, theater, creative writing, and play, has often been left out of the array of recognized psychotherapeutic approaches to traumatic stress. One reason for this derives from the marginalization of the arts themselves within modern society. Their impact on quality of life, mental health, and general wellness is often misunderstood or devalued. Science is now providing the evidence for what humans have always known, making it increasingly plausible to explain just why the expressive arts may be uniquely effective when it comes to addressing traumatic stress. Why incorporate expressive arts in your work? The primary intention of this book is to describe the psychotherapeutic benefits of expressive arts therapy in work with trauma. It also explains key frameworks and approaches that all practitioners can apply to their work with traumatized individuals to help them actively address overwhelming reactions and harness the power of the arts, play, and imagination for health and well-being. When speaking to audiences about how to apply expressive arts therapy with children, adults, and families, I often ask them to consider these questions. What if you could actually enhance your current approach to helping individuals with traumatic stress? What if you could introduce them to approaches that support self-regulation and assist them in experiencing the body's response to trauma in a safe manner? What if you could help individuals learn and practice these skills in playful and enlivening ways? And what if you could help them to use imagination to create new, reparative narratives that transform the traumatic memories that reside in both mind and body? Expressive arts therapy is a circumscribed form of psychotherapy grounded in arts-based methodology and bottom-up approaches that capitalize on the sensory-based qualities of movement, music and sound, visual arts, dramatic enactment, and other forms of creative communication. However, expressive arts therapy is also value-added when combined with effective approaches therapists already use to successfully affect change. These include verbal forms of psychotherapy, somatically based models, mindfulness practices, and even brain-based methods involving reprocessing and neurofeedback. If you are a psychotherapist using one or more of these approaches, this book is an invitation to begin to integrate drawing, movement, music, creative writing, improvisation, and play in your work. These expressive methods will enhance your relationship with your clients and teach them sensory-based approaches that support affect regulation and a sense of safety. These approaches will also help both children and adults identify their body's responses to distress, transform trauma-laden stories into resilient narratives, and relearn how to experience pleasure and aliveness once again. Even if you have had minimal arts experience, I hope you will be convinced that these approaches are powerful means of communication that capture not only the brain's explicit imprint of traumatic stress, but also the body's implicit experience that does not translate easily through words alone. If you are an art therapist, dance movement therapist, music therapist, or drama therapist, you may already have many of the foundational skills described in this book. But you may not have considered how you can strengthen your approach by strategically including other art forms in your work, ones that you may not have considered, such as drawing, movement, sound, improvisation, play, and storytelling. It is this integrative experience that can make a difference in clients' ability to more quickly and effectively address traumatic stress and engage their own healing processes. For expressive arts therapists, I hope this book becomes a framework for art-based approaches to traumatic stress that are based not only in neurobiology, but also in our growing understanding of culturally relevant healing practices that are found only in the arts. How the book is organized. The first three chapters of this book provide an overview of major concepts and frameworks. Chapter 1 explains the origins of expressive arts therapy and its long history as a form of trauma reparation and integration, and provides 8 key reasons to integrate expressive approaches within psychotherapy. Chapter 2 reviews trauma-informed frameworks, including the role of adverse events, historical and intergenerational trauma, and social justice. It also outlines the basic principles of trauma-informed expressive arts therapy and a 4-part culturally relevant model for the arts as healing practices. Chapter 3 explains how the expressive arts can be used to address trauma through a brain-body framework and how to apply a bottom-up or top-down approach to trauma intervention. Subsequent chapters describe how to integrate expressive arts therapy into psychotherapeutic practice with children, adults, families, and groups. Because expressive arts add a unique dynamic to trauma work, Chapter 4 addresses how they can be used to develop and support safe, resonant, and reparative relationships. Chapters 5 and 6 explain how specific arts-based approaches can enhance an internalized sense of safety and the ability to self-regulate and stabilize trauma reactions. Chapter 7 provides multiple strategies for applying expressive methods to working with the body and helping individuals safely identify traumatic stress in their bodies. Strategies for unpacking trauma narratives are explained in detail in Chapter 8, including how stories are told not only through verbal communication, but also through movement, imagery, and other arts-based expressions. Chapter 9 covers the role of resilience in trauma work and how expressive arts provide unique opportunities to support an internal sense of mastery and competence necessary to overcome distress. Finally, Chapter 10 takes on the topic of meaning-making, a critical element in trauma recovery, and explains how expressive arts therapy develops and supports imagination in the healing process. If you work with traumatized children, adults, families, or communities, you probably know that the individuals you see in your agency or practice often struggle with communicating their experiences through talk alone. You may also recognize that they need action-oriented, participatory, and safe experiences that address immobilizing hyperactivation or dissociation and withdrawal. Effective therapists appreciate and support both their clients' style of communication as well as strategies that help bring out the best in their clients within the psychotherapeutic relationship. I hope the concepts and practices described in this book help your clients safely express the impact of trauma on their lives and support them in actively mobilizing their own resources to repair, restore, and recover. Chapter 1. Expressive Arts Therapy, Going Beyond the Limits of Language. Psychological trauma can be a life-changing experience that affects multiple facets of health and well-being. The nature of trauma is to impact the mind and body in unpredictable and multidimensional ways. It can be a highly subjective experience that is difficult or even impossible to explain with words. It also can impact the body in highly individualized ways and result in complex symptoms that affect memory, social engagement, and quality of life. While many people overcome trauma with resilience and without long-term effects, many do not. Trauma's impact often requires approaches that address the sensory-based experiences many survivors report. Expressive arts therapy, the purposeful application of art, music, dance and movement, dramatic enactment, creative writing, and imaginative play, is largely a nonverbal way of self-expression of feelings and perceptions. More importantly, they are action-oriented and tap implicit, embodied experiences of trauma that can defy expression through verbal therapy or logic. In the fall of 1980, I began my first work with individuals who had experienced psychological trauma. I had just graduated with a master's degree in art therapy and was immediately hired for my first position as an art and play therapist for children and their mothers from violent homes at a community shelter. I was incredibly happy to get any job where I could use my newly acquired degree, especially since art therapy was very much considered to be a novel approach to treatment and no research yet existed to establish its efficacy. When I interviewed for the position, to my surprise, the staff was unexpectedly enthusiastic about my experience and education in art and play therapy methods. As they showed me around the facility, they stopped at a room that a social worker was using to see children for individual and group sessions. On one of the tables, there was a set of family puppets that appeared to have been decapitated. When I asked about the puppets, a staff member replied that, "The social worker is just not having much luck getting the children to talk. That's the second set of puppets they destroyed this month." It was easy to understand that the children perhaps did not want to verbalize their experiences and feelings and might respond more favorably to a less verbal approach. Although I knew very little about child witnesses to violence and what were then called battered women, This first impression became the foundation for a personal journey to understand how traumatic events impact us and why less verbal approaches may be an important piece in trauma reparation. As I anxiously began my first week as a therapist, the first individuals I encountered challenged essentially all of the education and supervision I had accumulated over the previous 2 years. Just about everything I had been taught did not seem to apply to what these children and adults brought into the treatment setting. What I had been taught about art therapy was largely based on psychoanalytic theory, emphasizing interpreting art expressions to achieve insight and resolution of emotional conflicts. With children, art therapy involved evaluation of symbolic content as a way to identify personality traits or defense mechanisms, or it simply became a form of special art education that focused on developmental benchmarks. In reality, none of these approaches appealed to me, and even while I was in graduate school, I sought other ways of working with individuals, including Gestalt therapy, Carl Rogers' person-centered and humanistic approaches, and Eugene Gendlin's idea of the felt sense. I repeatedly returned to the idea that the processes involved in arts-based expression within a psychotherapeutic context contained the healing factor, and that interpretation of imagery was not the main source of repair and transformation. What I subsequently learned during my first years as a psychotherapist influenced my worldview of how individuals respond to traumatic events in my current work, and formed a crucible that has guided the development of concepts outlined in this book. The treatment of trauma continues to be a challenge to practitioners, and it requires a variety of approaches. This first chapter begins with some of the clinical experiences that influenced my understanding of expressive arts therapy within the context of psychological trauma. It also provides an introduction to the arts in psychotherapy and an overview of expressive arts with an emphasis on its role in trauma intervention. Telling without talking. Sandra and her 9-year-old daughter Sally and 5-year-old son Mike were one of the first families I saw as a new practitioner. They came to the shelter after a particularly violent altercation that left Sandra with numerous bruises and a swollen eye socket. I soon learned that this was a typical scenario for Sandra, who had fled to the shelter on several other occasions when her husband became violently abusive. Sally often took on the role of rescuer, dialing the emergency number and giving the address to an emergency responder and asking law enforcement, "Please come to our house again." When altercations occurred between Sandra and her husband, Mike tried on at least one occasion to stop his father from hurting his mother by using his toy sword to hit and stab the assailant. During the most recent incident, Mike cowered in a corner behind a chair while Sally screamed the family's location to the person taking her 911 call. When I asked Sandra to tell me whatever she wanted to about what typically happened at home during a violent episode, she started to speak, but suddenly became silent. Because she looked as if talking was painful, I simply nodded empathetically and did not press her to communicate. During the years I worked at this facility and subsequent agencies that treated individuals who experienced assault, I simply came to accept the fact that for some reason, language was difficult for many of these abused women. Shelter staff speculated that women and children did not want to say too much because it might endanger them if they have to return to live with a perpetrator. Alternatively, some mistrusted staff because giving out sensitive information might lead to a protective services investigation and removal of child custody. While these were plausible reasons for silence, I also felt that something else was interfering with verbal communication. Sandra, like many other women I would meet at the shelter, seemed to try to speak, but appeared to actually choke when trying to answer my questions about the incidents that brought her and her family to the facility. Mike was also remarkably silent. When he first arrived at the shelter with his mother and sister, he was not only mute, but also withdrawn and remote. Later, during his first session in the art and play therapy room, he quickly gravitated to the sand tray, taking various miniature figures from the shelf and moving them methodically in the sand as if I was not there with him. In contrast to my other experiences with preschool children who find joy and laughter in playing with toys in the sand, Mike was just the opposite. His affect only became more depressed and anxious as he rearranged figures in the box, and he did not interact with me unless I initiated contact. While he did not speak during this initial session, in sessions during the following week, he described limited scenarios for me about the police coming to get a bad monster who was hurting and hitting everyone, represented in the sand tray by a miniature figure of a gorilla, the monster, and miniature police figures, multiple cars, and an ambulance, the rescuers. Despite the numerous responders, none could capture and contain the gorilla, who often ran wild throughout the sand tray, knocking down everything in its path. This story recurred each time Mike came to the playroom. He said very little, moving figures around the sand tray. Although he was likely portraying an actual trauma narrative he had experienced, it was apparent that he was not gaining relief from continually reenacting the story. In contrast, Sally was quite responsive and open to verbal communication with me. She showed initiative and even offered to help me organize art supplies, puppets, and toys for the other children who come to the playroom. On the days when I may have felt a little bit overwhelmed, Sally would quickly sense my fatigue and offer to bring me a snack from the shelter kitchen or insist that I sit down and take a rest. Her composure and positive affect did not make sense to me, given what she had experienced at home on numerous occasions. Her paintings, however, conveyed a very different story and were unlike anything I had seen in art expressions by children Sally's age. At each art therapy session, she methodically included the color black within the center of each image or object. See figures 1.1 and 1.2, which can be found in the print and ebook versions of this book. While I do not subscribe to any specific universal interpretations of children's drawings, her paintings did have unusual idiosyncratic characteristics that communicated something both intriguing and worrisome. While a psychoanalytic view might simply attribute this repetition to an emotional source, I wondered if this child was conveying something more than just the feeling, that her body was responding in some way to the chronic violence she witnessed through her art products. Several things struck me about Sally. First, she seemed to be able to circumvent any verbalization about her experiences of witnessing family violence by distracting me with chatty conversation, avoiding talking about her experiences that were possibly too overwhelming to disclose. Second, I eventually began to wonder if Sally herself was experiencing a physical impact of repetitive stress in her body. I had been taking a social work course at the local university and was learning about the work of Hans Selye, 1976, and other researchers who were just beginning to identify the impact of stress on physical health. Of course, practically nothing in the existing literature mentioned the impact of chronic stress on children, and childhood traumatic stress was not yet a diagnosable condition. But Sally's paintings turned out to be pivotal in my thinking about each child I subsequently saw at the shelter program. Sally, in fact, had a very serious duodenal ulcer that was eventually diagnosed by a visiting physician who was surprised that the child did not complain about the extreme pain she probably experienced on a daily basis. After working with Sally, I began asking all children and mothers I saw at the shelter what they were experiencing in their bodies. While most mothers did not always have an immediate response to my question, most children did, inevitably telling me about pounding headaches, belly aches, nausea, and generalized body pain. These sensations often turned up in art expressions, especially when they were asked, "How do you feel today?" Figure 1.3. What I learned from these children about how their bodies responded to stress and how they communicated it in nonverbal ways formed a foundation for capitalizing on the embodied qualities of expressive arts to help survivors to tell without talking about the somatic experience of trauma. Breaking the silence. Of all the families I saw during the first year of working at the shelter, one in particular provided a comprehensive lesson about the wide range of reactions resulting from multiple chronic traumatic events. Joelle, 29 years of age, her 11-year-old daughter, Krista, and her 8-year-old son, Joey, presented a very complicated history to social services on admittance to the shelter. Joelle reported that her husband threatened violence to all family members, although she was unclear about exact details and, in general, was very guarded and hesitant to provide any detailed information about the family. Krista was selectively mute and appeared distant and withdrawn. She barely could answer any questions the social worker or I asked her on the first day. In contrast, Joey was full of energy, crawling on top of tables in the intake office, playing with pencils and notepads, and crawling into my lap on several occasions. He was spontaneous, talkative, and endearing, presenting more like a 4 or 5-year-old than a boy his chronological age. During the family's month-long stay at the shelter, I worked with Krista and Joey 2 to 3 times a week, seeing them for approximately 10 sessions. Krista, despite all my best efforts, was largely unresponsive to invitations to participate in art making, preferring to remain silently watching Joey engage in play and artistic expression. I quickly realized that based on his art products and the characteristics of his play activity, Joey was displaying some significant developmental delays. He also clearly had speech problems and was generally quite clumsy in both fine and gross motor skills. In fact, Joey often, for no apparent reason, fell out of his seat while sitting at the art table and had problems with balance when standing. But at least he was engaging with me and the therapy sessions. In contrast, Krista was not forthcoming and generally seemed distant, almost as if she were in a different time and place. One of the only ways I could engage her was through reading storybooks to Joey. Krista would sit right next to me, watching me turn each page of the book and nodding and smiling as I animatedly read a story aloud. Like Joey, her behavior seemed to be that of a much younger child than her chronological age, and like a younger child, she seemed comforted by the calming prosody of my voice. Krista displayed yet another reaction that I would see in numerous children and adults, not only in my work with domestic violence survivors, but also in individuals who endured physical or sexual assault during childhood. When introduced to a male therapist who helped me run drama therapy groups for children, Krista instantly became completely immobile, unable to speak or respond to anything I said to her. Eventually, she began to cry silently. My only option at that time was to put her in the care of another staff member with whom she eventually relaxed. My very gentle and sensitive colleague and I were completely baffled by her reaction, but we recognized that he was the obvious reason for her immobilization. During the next year, the family returned to the facility. Joelle had now divorced her husband and stated that she had a live-in boyfriend who she reported was physically abusive to her. Although Joey did well during the family's first of 3 stays at the shelter, he did not display the resilience he previously demonstrated. Intake staff learned from Joelle that both children had been physically assaulted by the live-in boyfriend and that Krista may have been sexually abused. Child Protective Services became involved, concluded that these reports were accurate, and began investigation of the alleged perpetrator. The physical and emotional maltreatment had taken its toll on Joey, and one day, while I was attending a conference near the shelter, he threatened to leap out of a second-story window in the facility. Joelle was at a meeting outside the residence on that morning, so I was called to return to the shelter to literally talk Joey off a window ledge because he asked for Mrs. Kathy to please come right away. Although this dramatic moment of being called back to the facility because of a suicidal child gave me some serious anxiety, the instant Joey saw me, he immediately ended his threat and ran to me for a hug. In that moment, I wondered just what was so incredibly powerful in this boy's life that caused him to resort to this action, and, at the same time, I felt reassured that he knew how to seek adult helpers when distressed. Having no debriefing skills for post-suicide attempts in children, I was compromised as to what to do in that moment, but Joey was very willing to draw a picture for me of what he was feeling at the time, figure 1.4. His drawing depicts a sad little face with hair standing up straight and loose teeth floating around in his mouth. I did ask him if he would like to include a body, but he declined, saying that, quote, "the picture is right this way." At that point, Joey was very agitated while looking at the picture he created for me, spontaneously commenting that his, quote, mother would finally be sad for me 'cause I was dead. Obviously, ending his life was the ultimate attention-getting action that he believed would impact his mother and leave her with the guilt of his demise. Although I was not conscious of the important role of getting the body moving during moments of immobilization, my intuition.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?